Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Renner, a senior researcher with the World Watch Institute, who looks at the fate of Iraq's vast oil wealth, now under the control of the Bush administration and the U.S. military. Michael Marriott, executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who discusses the White House-backed energy bill advocating oil drilling in Alaska's wilderness areas and the construction of new nuclear power plants across the U.S. And Robert Rabin of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, who talks about the U.S. Navy's May 1st withdrawal from the Puerto Rican island of Vieques after 60 years of using the area as a bombing and artillery range. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The World Press Review magazine reports that a force of 2,000 American troops are headed for war-torn Mindanao, the site of a long-running Muslim insurgency in the southern Philippines. This is only the latest in a series of joint military exercises that the Pentagon has conducted over the last year. The stated goal is to crush Abu Sayyaf, the terror group linked to Al-Qaeda. But Mindanao is also home to the Moro National Liberation Front, which for decades resisted Christian influences in the south and signed a peace treaty with the Philippine government in 1996. American troops first ventured into Mindanao over a century ago during the 1899 Philippine-American War and stayed until 1914. During the period 1903 to 1906, U.S. Marines killed over 3,000 Muslim fighters in a brutal pacification campaign. After the Philippines won independence in 1946, a flood of Christians settled in Muslim zones. By the early 1970s, the native Moros only owned 30% of the land. Soon a powerful separatist movement took hold. So far, Philippine President Gloria Arroyo has resisted U.S. pressure to go after another rebel splinter group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, and label them as terrorists. Instead, Arroyo may go after the rebels' political and economic backers and fight the corruption and smuggling that funds the Islamic movement. Most Asian observers feel any direct U.S. role in combat in Mindanao would backfire by reminding people of past abuses by American troops and stir up pan-Islamic solidarity. For the average supermarket consumer in industrialized nations, local weather conditions largely don't affect the selection of produce available. They can go down the aisles and buy a golden-shelled pineapple from the Ivory Coast, ginger dug from Chinese soil, or an Israeli avocado most of the year. There is little thought of the farmer who grew the fruits and vegetables, or the disappearing peasant culture in Mexico. Consumers also have little understanding of how small farmers have been squeezed by big food conglomerates in recent years. According to the New Internationalist magazine, farmers in Britain get just 7% of all the money consumers spend on food, down from nearly 60% right after World War II. In 1957, there were 22 million farmers in the European Union. Now only 7 million European farmers remain. So it was not surprising when British dairy farmers started blockading supermarkets a few years back to protest the lowest dairy prices in 30 years. Widespread opposition among farmers and citizens to gene-altered food is part of the global resistance to corporate control over agriculture. As Indra Lubis, a leader of 13 Indonesian peasant farm groups, complained, Monsanto and other food giants want to control food and cotton production. But, she said, we are independent when we develop our own agriculture. In his final days, outgoing Security and Exchange Commission Chairman Harvey Pitt sided with corporate reformers by getting the mutual fund industry to disclose its proxy votes on heated issues like executive pay. It was a move long sought by shareholder activists like the AFL-CIO, church groups, and environmentalists. Activists have long been confronted by a wall of secrecy around mutual fund companies that currently own 23% of all corporate stock. As Ron Blackwell of the AFL-CIO's Corporate Affairs Department told The Nation magazine, this is our money, and they are managing it, and they're in the pockets of industry. Conflicts of interest were exposed by the push by Connecticut-based toolmaker Stanley Works to establish itself as a Bermuda-based corporation in order to avoid paying $30 million in taxes. Unions put pressure on Fidelity, a large Stanley stockholder, to disclose its proxy vote on the move to Bermuda. The mutual fund giant refused. It was assumed that Fidelity backed the plan, which initially passed, but was later withdrawn because of a challenge by Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal. The rule on the disclosure of proxy votes will now give union members and shareholder activists the information they need to pressure mutual fund companies to vote in their interests or to move their money to a firm which does. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
While the U.S. military and civilian appointees of the Bush administration attempt to restore order and repair Iraq's infrastructure, protests against American occupation continue across the war-torn nation. Over the last several weeks, U.S. soldiers shot and killed 18 civilians and wounded nearly 100 demonstrators who took to the streets angrily objecting to the presence of American forces in the city of Fallujah. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Jay Garner, the man appointed by President Bush to rule post-war Iraq, is working to establish an interim government by selecting delegates to a National Assembly. The Provisional Assembly, to be handpicked by Iraqi exiles and Bush administration allies, would then in turn select an executive council or prime minister. One of the biggest questions confronting the White House is the administration of Iraq's oil industry with the second largest proven reserves in the world. A partial answer to that question was revealed when the U.S. appointed former Shell Oil Company CEO Philip J. Carroll to be chairman of an advisory committee that will oversee Iraq's oil industry. But even before the U.S. launched its war against Baghdad in violation of the United Nations Charter, the State Department was meeting with oil company executives and exile groups to plan for the management and possible privatization of Iraq's oil sector. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Renner, a senior researcher with the World Watch Institute, who discusses the role Iraq's oil wealth may have played in the Bush administration's decision to prosecute a war against Baghdad and the likelihood that the industry will soon be privatized and offered up to U.S.-based oil companies.
Well, you know, it's interesting, certainly, when one listens to any of the administration officials, any of the spokespeople, there is, of course, sort of an immediate denial that any of what has been happening in Iraq related to the war, leading up to the war, is even in the remotest way related to oil. And that kind of really strains credulity, I think, because clearly it's hard to understand what's been happening in Iraq and more generally in the Middle East for really many decades now without looking at the fact that this is the region that by far has the richest oil reserves in the world. That's something that becomes actually more and more important because the United States and other countries are becoming more and more dependent on imported oil. And therefore, at the very least, securing access or having political leverage over the terms under which access is made available to the oil is certainly very important. It's been important for previous administrations. I think this is something that has not just gone away.
Tell us a little bit about the discussions that were going on within the State Department and oil corporations here in the United States. What, if anything, was discussed before the war actually broke out about a role for U.S.-based petroleum companies in Iraq's oil industry?
There were apparently a number of meetings, both involving State Department officials, but apparently also Pentagon officials, Iraqi exile figures, and various representatives from U.S. oil companies. But we don't really know what was discussed at these meetings. I mean, some of the participants even went so far as to deny that any meetings had taken place. And I think very clearly they were tight-lipped because this is an extremely sensitive subject and was, of course, even more sensitive before the war because the Bush administration kept insisting that it had not decided to go to war, that war was supposedly a last resort and so on. I think what's been happening, though, by and large, and this is really what we've heard more recently, is that particularly among key officials in the Pentagon, there is a very strong push toward a privatization of the oil industry and apparently actually pretty much across the spectrum of Iraqi industries. The details, again, of course, we don't really know, but I think that would imply that a far more important role would be given to representatives of non-Iraqi oil companies than had been the case before. We know, of course, that we have had a number of privatizations, both in the oil sector and elsewhere, in many, many countries around the world. And the argument in favor of that had always been that it creates greater economic growth and greater opportunity for everybody. Everybody will be better off. But I think the reality in many, many countries was that the discrepancies between poor and rich increased dramatically. And it's not clear why Iraq would, you know, come out better, why that kind of an outcome would not be present in Iraq as well, particularly if this is being pushed by basically some of the same kinds of officials and the same kinds of economists that had been pushing earlier privatization programs elsewhere. So that to me, I think, is one big concern.
There was enormous suspicion as to the motives of the United States when it invaded Iraq, and many governments, many people around the world thought that a U.S. goal in Iraq was to gain access to the oil. So if now an Iraqi government under U.S. tutelage all of a sudden privatizes the oil, won't that not only raise eyebrows, but maybe even cause a lot of unrest in Iraq itself and around the region?
I would think the answer is quite likely, yes. I mean, it certainly would add to the suspicions that are clearly out there. And I think also given even the very early response within Iraq to the U.S. occupation, which certainly was not all positive, one would have to assume that some of these moves would actually add to the hostility that seems to be present quite strongly in Iraq. There is, I think, a big question in terms of why is the administration pushing so hard for an advisory council to the Iraqi oil ministry, which of course is now in process of being put together. Why is that advisory council being headed by the former CEO of Shell Oil, which is the U.S. subsidiary of Royal Dutch Shell? Why, you know, is one of the other key advisors a person who was formerly with ExxonMobil? What many analysts of the oil industry have, I think, agreed on for a long time is that Iraq was really quite capable of running its oil industry. There's the technical skill, the management knowledge, and so on. And while it's certainly true that much of the facilities of that industry are now in tatters, largely because of the long years of sanctions and Iraq having been unable to import spare parts and equipment and so on, that skill and know-how within Iraq has not gone away. So there is, I think, a big question mark attached to this question. Why is there this need for an advisory council? Why not just try to reconstitute the Iraqi oil ministry, you know, let them run things, and basically not try to really just change the entire structure? So I think a lot is at stake, because clearly then the question becomes, you know, what are the terms? Who really wins out? Who loses? You know, how much of the benefit, how much of the revenues do go to the local civilian population? I mean, we hear a lot about this in terms of rhetoric, but not very much in terms of specifics.
That was Michael Renner, senior researcher with the World Watch Institute. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-452-1999 or visit their website at www.worldwatch.org. When the Bush administration first took office, Vice President Dick Cheney held a series of closed-door meetings with corporate executives, including officials from Enron, to assist in the formulation of White House energy policy. After the collapse of Enron and the scandals surrounding California's electricity deregulation, Congress unsuccessfully sought records of those meetings to determine how much influence people like Enron's CEO Ken Lay may have had on the president's energy policy. With Republicans in control of the White House and Congress, the Bush administration is continuing its push to weaken environmental regulations, now preventing the exploitation of oil and coal reserves in wilderness areas. Another cornerstone of Bush and Cheney's secretly arrived at energy policy is promotion of nuclear power. The Republican-controlled Congress is ready to go along. An energy bill, already passed by the GOP-led House, advocates oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and offers corporate subsidies for the construction of new nuclear power plants. A companion bill is now being debated in the Senate. Since the 1979 nuclear accident at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, grassroots opposition to nuclear power has effectively prevented the construction of more new atomic power plants than already exist in the U.S. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Michael Marriott, executive director of NIRS, or the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who discusses provisions in the Republican energy bill and what opponents are doing to mitigate its worst aspects.
It would allow the U.S. Congress to appropriate money, billions and billions of dollars of your taxpayer dollars, to build new nuclear power plants. This would be a program that would pay up to 50% of the cost of up to 8 new nuclear reactors somewhere in the country. And these would be subsidies to private utilities, either through loan guarantees or credit or perhaps even direct grants. If you're looking at an average cost of a reactor, we could be talking, $30 billion or more of taxpayer money is a direct subsidy to build new nuclear reactors, which we don't need in this country to begin with. The bill would authorize $1 billion or more to build another new nuclear reactor, apparently in Idaho, as a test reactor to produce hydrogen for President Bush's hydrogen fuel cell vehicle program, which is beginning to look a lot less like a vehicle program and a lot more like a another prop for the nuclear power industry. In fact, there's a whole nuclear hydrogen initiative in this bill that is what the Bush administration is pushing, because they want this whole fuel cell concept they have for vehicles, which sounds pretty good on the surface. They want to build a whole new nuclear infrastructure to produce this hydrogen. So you really got to wonder which is the motivation here. The bill would reauthorize the Price-Anderson Act indefinitely. The Price-Anderson Act is the insurance scheme that was first set up in 1957 that limits the liability of nuclear plant operators in the event of an accident. So these are the kinds of things that are in this energy bill. The House version of the bill does include oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which has been very controversial. There's very sweeping provisions that would change some of the ways that we distribute electricity. There's really very little incentive for renewables and energy efficiency programs. I mean, it's an energy policy that is based largely on the Bush-Cheney vision, although it may even be more radical than that, if that's possible, and really would affect how we produce and use energy in this country for decades. It's a very dangerous bill. It's really pretty shocking. We've never seen legislation, we've never seen Congress actually consider handing over taxpayer money directly to nuclear utilities to build nuclear reactors. And the reason that they're doing this is because the utilities themselves don't want to put up their own money for new nuclear plants. We don't have an electricity shortage in this country right now. In fact, we have an electricity surplus.
Let me ask you one thing. I actually had talked to someone a while ago about, there was a report that they were involved with regarding security at nuclear power plants. Now, despite many years of warnings and proposals for improving it, very, very little has been done, even post 9/11. Many of us have been worried for a long time about possible, even before we were so worried about terror attacks, just about, accidents. What do you think about the ability of the existing nuclear power plants to withstand sabotage or terror attacks?
Well, we've been critical of security at nuclear facilities for quite a long time, and certainly predating 9/11. And I think it's important to remember that no terrorist has ever threatened a windmill or a wind farm. It's the nature of nuclear power and the vast damage that can be caused by the striking at a nuclear plant that makes it a potentially attractive target. One of the first things I wrote when I began working at NIRS back in 1985, I think it was an article called Reactors as Weapons for the Enemy. It's incumbent upon us to realize that these are targets, these are potential weapons for the enemy, and while we can make them somewhat secure, we can certainly make them more secure than they are now, we can never make them 100% secure. In that context, I mean, just another legislative thing I'll bring up is that despite 9/11 and despite fairly well-documented security deficiencies, Congress has still not passed any legislation to increase security at nuclear power plants. The Congress almost did last session. They didn't get it through. Now the Senate Environment Committee is considering this legislation, and in making it stronger from last year, they're trying to make it weaker.
That was Michael Marriott, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Contact the NIRS by calling area code 202-328-0002 or visit their website at www.nirs.org. On May 1st, the U.S. Navy ended its 60 years of bombing exercises on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Hundreds of protesters broke through a fence at the bombing range of Camp Garcia after the midnight deadline, waving the island's flag and shouting, "Vieques sí, Navy no." Some witnesses charge hooded protesters burned Navy vehicles and destroyed government property there. Almost 25,000 acres on the east side of Vieques, roughly two-thirds of the island, were expropriated through a series of U.S. laws at the beginning of the Second World War. The Navy took immediate possession of all lands needed for military purposes and used the island of Vieques, described by the Navy as the crown jewel in the Caribbean, for bombing, artillery, and for amphibious landing exercises. Families and farmers had to leave the area with little or no compensation. Organizers have long claimed the military exercises on Vieques caused the population of 9,000 there to suffer one of the highest cancer rates in Puerto Rico, in addition to other chronic illnesses. The last 3 years brought intensive campaigning demanding the Navy leave Vieques, triggered by the accidental death of 24-year-old David Sanes Rodriguez on April 19, 1999. Hundreds of protesters have been arrested for engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience and other forms of protest. Puerto Rican Governor Sila Calderon announced she will ask Congress to put Vieques on the national priority list for an environmental cleanup of the bombing range. Robert Rabin is with the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. He spoke with your reporter Denise Manzari about the vigilance necessary to ensure a thorough cleanup of the explosives and toxic waste left behind by the Navy.
We just finished a four-day campaign of intense celebration. Thousands and thousands of people from Vieques, from the main island of Puerto Rico. People were in from California, Chicago, from New Jersey, from Boston, from Washington, D.C., and from New York, among other places, to participate in the celebration of the official cessation of naval bombing and the end of the U.S. military presence on the eastern end of Vieques. In January, following the April 19th death of David Sanes, then President Clinton and the governor of Puerto Rico at the time, Pedro Rosselló, signed an agreement to allow the Navy to continue bombing for 3 years more until 2003. And we continue to demand for an immediate end to the bombing. As you know, significant civil disobedience actions, close to 2,000 people arrested during that process. And we certainly were successful at minimizing the bombing. The Navy was forced to use only inert weapons, and on many, many occasions, naval operations were stopped and in some cases canceled because of the civil disobedience action.
Will the Navy retain financial responsibility over the cleanup in Vieques?
Well, the Navy is both morally and legally responsible for the cleanup, without a doubt. Unfortunately, the Navy has developed over the course of decades mechanisms to try to get out of that responsibility. And one of those mechanisms is, in fact, turning the land over to the Department of the Interior and classifying the lands as refuge areas, even though the Navy actually destroyed all the wilderness on the bombing range, for instance. So this is a tactic that we're very knowledgeable about, so we're prepared to do battle with this and to force the Navy and the federal government to come up with the millions and millions of dollars that they must spend to do the cleanup here. It's a monumental contamination disaster. And again, the community organizations, the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, for instance, we're very determined to continue the struggle to maintain our organized apparatus and continue to work with community organizations to pressure the government of Puerto Rico, to pressure the government of the United States to make sure we get a profound, complete cleanup.
Will there be independent environmentalist scientists following this cleanup and doing assessment of cleanup as the Navy continues to do that?
Well, that's definitely what's on our agenda, and it's part of our demands that have been sent to the Interior Department, the Navy, the government of Puerto Rico, the Congress, the President, and the Environmental Protection Agency, a series of demands that have been sent out on a couple of occasions over the past month or two, include a demand for Puerto Rico scientists and environmental scientists who have worked with the community of Vieques, people who are knowledgeable about military contamination. And we need to have independent scientific work here because we cannot trust the Navy to clean up its own mess.
And finally, Robert Rabin, what about perhaps some unexploded ordnance that may be in other parts of the island? Are they going to take care of that as well?
Well, this is probably one of the most severe dangers. The legacy of the Navy in many parts of the world, you know, has meant death and destruction for many, many people. Vieques, as part of Puerto Rico, as part of the colonial possession of the United States, is subject to U.S. law. So we would hope that the Navy does come up with the funding necessary to remove unexploded ordnance and to clean up the environmental contamination that is concentrated on the eastern end of the island but extends throughout a very good portion of Vieques. It's a testimony to the effectiveness of a people united in militant and active nonviolence. And it's very important for us, you know, to have the bombing stop because of what that means for peace on Vieques. But also, we're very happy to know that the Navy will never again use Vieques to prepare for, to train for, killing people in other parts of the world, as it has done with Vieques over the last half a century and more.
That was Robert Rabin of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. For more information, call area code 787-741-0716 or visit the committee's website at www.viequeslibre.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.